Sometimes it's both fun and informative to go back to basics a little bit, and we're going to do just that today. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, we're going to start out our home improvement and repair discussion talking about walls. John Freiberger of Freiberger & Associates in Fitchburg comes by every few months to share what he knows. John, good to see you.
Great to be here.
I got you drinking your coffee there. And Ken Adams of Adams Design Construction in Madison is his partner for these programs. Ken, good to see you.
Good morning. Yes, nice to see you.
Thanks for coming in, both of you, on this snowy Wisconsin morning. And we will certainly talk about some winter issues that people are probably having with their homes. But first, we're going to start out talking about walls. First of all, when we say a wall, what are we talking about, John?
Well, the easy way of thinking about it is a wall is something that separates something from something. So your garden wall separates your flowers from the rabbits that want to get in there.
With any luck.
The castle wall kept the barbarians out, and our house walls have all kinds of different jobs to do. And they've done them differently over time, which is one of the things we started thinking about. You know, Ken and I have been around just about forever.
Since the barbarians.
Since the barbarians, I remember.
Well, I think you're 3 years
I was inside the
Santa
wall
Claus.
And he was outside. But you know, we've seen a lot of houses, everything from built in the 1850s up to the stuff that Ken is building today. So we thought we would talk just a little bit about how walls have changed. And we're going to focus on two things. Ken's going to talk a little bit about how things have changed structurally, the new materials that we're using, the things that hadn't been even invented when he and I got into business 200 years ago. And I'm going to talk a little bit about thermal efficiency and problems with water, because we're seeing a lot of those right now. And the other thing I want you to think of, and this is sort of a weird thought, but what's a roof? Well, roof is basically a wall on a slant, isn't it?
Well, that's interesting.
When you analyze a wall, you can almost analyze a roof and attic system the same as a wall. So, Ken, why don't you tell us about some of the things that you've seen and changes in the industry in the last 20 years with all the interesting new materials that we're integrating into our wall systems now?
Well, first, actually, if you can back up even from that and say, you know, traditionally, historically, what were walls made from and how has that changed?
Well, I mean, traditionally, walls were started out being made from stones piled up on each other, and then eventually they started to stuff mud in between the stones to keep reduce air infiltration. What do you suppose is next? Probably brickwork, and I think some of the old stuff, 4,000 or 5,000-year-old man-made brick started to become popular.
Well, we certainly saw mud brick in some areas, but in a lot of areas we saw tree materials, wood materials being used. And of course, in many areas we saw the skins of animals.
Well, tents, yes, of course.
Right.
And you know, a lot of first people housing.
Yurts
nomadic,
and things like
nomadic
that.
Nomadic housing, yes.
So in, let's say, early modern times,
sure.
Especially in the U.S., what were we seeing for wall construction materials?
Well, people moved to the United States prior to it becoming the United States, and it was these vast forests that seemed to go on forever with lots of wood. And so wood was, you know, traditionally people used what materials were available. Wood was plenty available.
And probably a lot easier than, say, quarrying stone or something like that.
It certainly requires less skill, less effort, and, you know, could go up faster, too. So you saw log houses be developed by Westerners who were just moving, or actually Europeans that were moving here. And in addition to the original stonework that they, you know, that stonemasons you know, brought those skills over. I'm sort of fumbling around here, but the point I'm getting at is I'm trying to get to wood, because that's the thing that
that's the
fundamental part of a wall above ground. Of course, foundations is a little bit of a different story. We can talk about that in a few minutes, but everything above ground is usually made, this infrastructure is made of wood. Now, instead of wood, people are using manufactured waste products of wood. So things like LVLs and T-joists, which are made of basically plywood that are formed and structured and engineered so that they can handle quite substantial loads.
And what's an LVL?
Well, an LVL is, if you can, everybody knows what plywood is. It's, you know, laminates of thin veneer, a lumber placed in, you know, usually cross grain. You know, one layer is one direction, the other layer is the next direction. If you could think of this as just a real thick piece of plywood that's been engineered to be able to handle loads, and usually they can handle stronger loads per lineal foot than dimension lumber, which is, you know, like 2x10, 2x8, 2x12, that sort of thing. And that's more for supporting, you know, supporting stuff above it. So traditionally here in the last 100 years, 150 years, we've been using stud walls. Studs are, everybody's heard of a 2x4. Mm-hmm. And they started out being 2 inches by 4 inches. It's interesting now that 2x4s are usually 1.5 inches by 3.5 inches. And in some locations, they're 3.25 inches by 1.25 inches.
So it's not even necessarily standard what people are calling a 2x4 anymore.
Well, 2x4 is that's the old-fashioned, that was the dimension before it was before they started machining them. But as they cut a 2x4 into a 2-inch by 4-inch, they have a lot of waste product, and they used to toss it out or burn it. Now they use it in things like plywoods, wafer board. You've heard of wafer board and stuff. I'm rambling again, but the point I'm getting at is that these 2x4s make up the vertical structure of the wall. And then those are nailed to 2x4s that are laid flat on the floor and flat on the ceiling. And as time's gone on, we've improved that. We've changed those 2x4s that are laid flat are called plates, and we've doubled up the top plates for structural strength and to keep the buildings from racking and twisting and so forth. And then the walls usually have sheathing put on the outside, and traditionally that was what's called a shiplap 1x8, and a shiplap has a little cutout, a little rabbit cutout, and that's so it's they lap over each other and they don't just butt and they actually have air and stuff has to move around a corner to get to it.
So going back to the using the waste, so that seems like it's a more green alternative to instead of, like you said, throwing out or burning
That's a big part of the future now, you know.
People, so we're not wasting as much.
Right. We're taking these wood shavings and wood chips and turning them into OSB is a very popular product that's used a lot on wall construction. Some people use it on roofs. Whether or not it's the best product for a roof is debatable, but it's extended the usefulness of lumber. LVL. The micro lambs is another word for LVL. That's another way to use waste products, thin pieces of wood that couldn't be used otherwise. And you're seeing that in more and more areas. You're seeing that in framing. You're seeing that in insulation. John will talk a lot about insulation. There's one green insulation out there that people use old denim jeans, basically, and they make an insulation out of it. That's a green product. Cellulose is insulation is basically...
That's plant fiber, right?
Yeah, well, it's basically old newspapers, isn't it, John?
Basically it is, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, so these are... one of the beauties of products like this is that they're relatively inexpensive and they're...
And they're more responsible as well.
They're more responsible, yeah.
We are talking about home repair and improvement with Ken Adams and John Freiberger. They come by every few months to share what they know, and they're happy to answer your questions as well. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And so, Ken, you were talking about how the insides, and we're really, are we talking about both exterior and interior walls when you're talking about the slats, you know, vertically and then the horizontal? Basically,
the outside walls are made to handle the roof load as well as be somewhat impermeable to the weather. The interior walls are there to partition off, as John said.
Really more cosmetic.
Well, not necessarily structural. Some interior walls are structural. They support the middle of the building.
Well, and I wanted to ask about that because especially watching things like HGTV and things, we often hear the term load-bearing wall. People think they're going to knock something out and have this great open concept and, that wall happens to be holding up the whole second story. So what does a load-bearing wall mean, John?
Basically, it means that some weight is devolving upon it. So if it's a first-floor wall, it could be the second-floor floor loads, plus it could be also the roof loads as well. And The loads work in several directions. There's the plain old, what we call negative moment, just the weight of, you know, the color TV and the dresser and all the stuff on the second floor that's pushing down on it. But the second thing is there's also lateral loads. And one of the things that we have to be very careful in our houses, especially when we take out those load-bearing walls mm-hmm. and we just put in a couple of columns and beams, is that we may actually destabilize things laterally. One of the big changes we've seen in the code in Wisconsin in the last few years is what's called wall bracing. Because we started building these really tall walls, these McMansions in the cornfields on top of the hill, and then we would put an 80-mile-an-hour wind against them, which is 20 pounds per square foot, and the things would fall over.
Wow.
So the Wisconsin Code and the National Code as well have really changed how we handle structures. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing some really new things like Simpson's strong walls, which are pre-manufactured sections that are going in that are rigid, both for taking this load from the top and also the lateral load. So we've created problems for ourselves with new materials and new ways of doing things in our ever bigger windows, and now we're trying to solve those problems with even more new materials. Hmm. And I guess we'll see how that works out.
Interesting. And so, Ken, you were talking about how, you know, we get the structure of the wall up mm-hmm. and then we put stuff over it. But I'm guessing that John's going to tell us that there's a whole lot inside that structure as well.
And that's a good point. It started out, the walls had sheathing on the outside, plaster on the inside, siding on the outside, and the walls were hollow. Then people started running gas lines in for gas lighting, and then electricity. And now, it's, you know, wall cavities were great for that thing mm-hmm. because it's a space that's 4 inches at the beginning.
Pleasing because you're not looking at all the wiring.
And then we realized that heat the houses cost money. And as that started to get more and more expensive, we started to experiment in insulation and how we could keep the house warm, mm-hmm. keep the heat from escaping, keep our bills down. It started out with very low-tech stuff. I know I've torn houses apart that have had like old newspapers crumpled
just
up in the
stuffed
wall.
Stuffed in there, yeah.
You know, there's rock wool. There's a whole history of stuff. John, why don't you take over? Because this is a really good expertise for you.
Yes, well, we've seen everything from plastering, putting lath and plaster in the middle of the wall. Mm-hmm. So the 2x4, the 4-inch cavity was divided into 2 1-inch cavities. So you had dead airspace. And believe it or not, that worked. Mm. It uh-huh. gave you 2 R1 airspaces.
I think they used a lot of horsehair in there as binders, didn't they?
Well, they used the horsehair in the plaster. Of course, then there's the houses that have the corn cob walls. Those are mostly out in the country.
Yeah.
Well, you use what you have, right?
You use what you have. But what was nice about these old walls is they were built of wood, mm-hmm. and a lot of that wood was white pine from Wisconsin, the same stuff they built schooners out of.
Old growth.
Right, yeah. Old mm-hmm. growth, tough wood. And we call these flow-through assemblies. And that meant that, well, heat went out of them, and we tried to stop that.
It flowed through them.
It did. Moisture flowed through them. But because the heat flowed through them and the wind flowed through them, they never got wet inside. So they stayed dry. Nowadays, with our new walls, with what, rather than wood, I call all these things was wood because it was wood at one time, these things react a little bit differently. And our walls are generally no longer flow-through walls. And this is why we are now seeing, when we get these ice dams running into the wall of a modern house, we are seeing some very serious problems. Whereas in my 1850s house, if I got an ice dam, which I don't because I insulate well, I wouldn't worry so much because I have wood rather than was wood. Mm-hmm. So we have to take a look at our wall assemblies nowadays and figure out not only how does it work structurally, how does it work thermally, but how do we dry the thing out if it gets wet or try to keep it from mm-hmm. from getting wet in the first place?
Mm-hmm. And we will take a look at that in just a moment. Ken Adams, John Freiberger joining us today to talk about home improvement and repair. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Now we are talking about home improvement and repair with Ken Adams and John Freiberger. They come by every couple months to share what they know. And we are starting out talking about walls. And actually, Cindy in De Pere had a question about something you guys mentioned. Hi, Cindy.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, and it's kind of strange because after I got off the phone, I started thinking of all these other things related to it. I was so interested in the blue jeans being an insulation, and I was wondering, what is the company that does this, and where do these blue jeans come from? Do they work with retail businesses, or
are they running around ripping them off people?
Well, yeah.
Ken, what do you know about those blue jeans as insulation?
I don't. The answer is I don't know much. I'm sorry, Cindy, I can't really help you with it. But there's some secondary information online. There's you could go to greenbuilding.com, I believe it is. They may have some information from you. The Journal of it's the Journal of Light Construction. It used to be the New England Journal of Construction. They have a lot of secondary information, articles and advertisers and things. So you should be able to find some information about it. I did some research about 4 or 5 years ago, and it was cost prohibitive for my client at that time. Things may change, you know. Jeans are. I don't know what the cost of jeans are.
And Cindy, did you say that you had come up with another question while you were waiting?
Well, I work at Goodwill Industries, and we get a lot of donations, and Goodwill is also a green organization. And I was just kind of like, wow, maybe that would be something that they would want to be involved in, if, you know, somehow. But anyway, that was
great.
Well, that's a very creative idea.
Yeah. Thanks for that, Cindy. And so let's go back to that insulation, whether it's blue jeans or not, John. So you said that one of the challenges is that we want to keep things warm, but we also don't want to kind of seal it in so much that if it does get wet, that moisture has nowhere to go.
That's correct. We have in houses, I mean, everybody's seen frost on their windows. If you live in Wisconsin, you have frost on your windows. Mm-hmm. Well, if you had X-ray vision and could see inside your walls and you have an old house, you may very well see that same frost on the inside of the sheathing, the interior wall side of the sheathing. Because as water vapor moves through the wall system, and that most of that is actually from airflow and some of it from diffusion, once it hits the point where we've got the dew point, which is usually the backside of the sheathing, it is going to condense. So we have to be able to dry that out. Now, in these old houses, even if you insulated them, they did eventually dry because they were flow through. But the Department of Interior National Historic Restoration Standard says that if Ken comes out and insulates an 1860s historic house, he has to put a vapor barrier air seal on the inside to try to limit the amount of water that's moving into this wall, because he's now limited the drying capacity of that wall.
Interesting.
Now, what happened in the 1970s is we got more efficient furnaces, we got the side-vented furnaces, we got the better windows. The number of air changes in our house really decreased, so the humidity went way up. And then we still kept putting humidifiers into houses that were already wet, and then they didn't work very well. Yeah. So we ended up getting a lot of wet houses. So somebody invented the vapor barrier, a sheet of plastic to put over the studs, with the theory that this was going to keep vapor from going into the wall. Well, it doesn't work. 48 states have gotten rid of it. Alaska and Wisconsin still have it.
We
still have it in the Wisconsin code. And what we really need in our houses, if we're going to keep the moisture out of the walls, is we need an air barrier, not a vapor barrier. And hopefully we'll get some changes in the Wisconsin code soon. We actually want to stop air movement that is carrying moisture from entering the wall. But if you work with a good architect or a good thermal designer, we can still design flow-through walls that will dry. It's a bit of work, and I have a lot of information on them, and if people email, I can send to them. But it is still possible to design a wall, but we really are getting to the point with our tight houses, with the limited air changes. Mm-hmm. Now, somebody's going to ask about a net zero house. I don't know if there's one in Wisconsin, but just think of a house where you have so limited air changes, one half an air change an hour, that you have all this humidity in the house that you have to mechanically control. Mm-hmm. If you don't control it, it's going into the walls. So this has become actually as much of a problem as ice dams or roof leaks, mm-hmm. as far as long-term damage to houses,
wow.
including mold in the walls.
Yeah, plus you can't see it, so the problem is happening while you're, you know, and you're blissfully mm-hmm. ignorant of it until you pull something off and
see it. Yeah.
Until something very significant happens. Yeah.
Wow. And so, John, I'm. It's so interesting that only Alaska and Wisconsin still have that. Is there a reason why it's still in place in Wisconsin? Is there an interest that's keeping it there, or has it just not really
I don't know. Wisconsin has always, I mean, we have our, going back to our progressive tradition way, way back, 1910, Wisconsin's always done things a little differently, and we've always been sort of leaders. And we were really one of the leaders in developing first heating codes and then uniform dwelling codes. And I think the state is a little bit loath to give up that tradition. As to why we haven't accepted what other people now accept, I'm not sure. We'd actually have to talk to one of the code people in building and safety. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll ask that at the next review. And things are changing. Now when we foam a wall, in the old days, we had to put plastic over it as well. Now we no longer do. So the state is indeed moving.
There are some things happening. You'd mentioned Alaska. And they use this project, the system called the remote system, which is it's about putting the insulation on the outside of the framing, putting the vapor barrier on the outside of the framing. The insulation goes outside of that, and you're keeping the inside of the sheathing above, or not above, but it doesn't reach the dew point.
That's correct.
So the
yes.
temperature doesn't reach the dew point, then you don't have to worry about moisture inside the wall cavity.
Right. That's one of the three designs that are used widely in the United States now for mm-hmm. drying to the interior.
They say it's very effective. Now, we don't see that much of it here, but we do see a lot of 1-inch and 2-inch foam on the outside of the structure, insulating the inside, and that has the same effect to a degree, although not as intelligently designed in. So go ahead.
No, I we are putting a lot of foam on the exterior of houses now. Part mm-hmm. of that is so that we span the thermal bridging that we're getting through the framing.
Yeah.
So very frequently on retrofits, we're stripping the exterior of houses. We're adding wind barriers and foam, and we are making very sure that we have a good air barrier so we're not moving moisture from the interior into that wall, and we're at the same time thermally decoupling the framing from the exterior.
We are talking with Ken Adams and John Freiberger about home improvement and repair. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Carl Christensen, our on-air producer, doing a great job. And he's happy to answer your calls at 1-800-642-1234. And we have some folks who would like to join the conversation. So let's go to the phones. Keith in Ontario. Hi, Keith.
Good morning. I have a question. We have a brick wall that we... a block concrete wall, and we put stud wall up with spray foam between the stud wall and the block wall, and then fiberglass in between. But what I'm really concerned about is the styrofoam and thermal bridging under the floor underneath it in between and what I'm really concerned about is the entire wall acting like a big radiator to suck the heat right out of the floor where there is no insulation underneath the bottom plate of the wall.
All right. John, did you want to take that?
So what we have here, it sounds like we've got concrete block laid over a concrete floor and without a thermal break. Mm-hmm. And those are really hard to retrofit because we don't know how that floor is working structurally. We'd hate to cut a gap into it to put an insulation material in. So the best that one can do is to make a small cut and do some discovery work, but that is a tough retrofit. Frequently, what we try to do on those systems is insulate them from the exterior. But it sounds like they've already insulated the wall from the interior. So I probably would have thought about that one a little bit and put the entire thermal barrier on the outside rather than the inside, or at least most of the thermal barrier on the outside, so that we could completely decouple.
Does that sound like John described your situation? Accurately.
Kind of. What I'm wondering is what is the heat loss, the R value, and the actual heat, what percentage of the heat bill would be lost through that conduction through the concrete floor to the outside wall and below the frost line and above the frost line? How will that affect our heat bill? Because we could still change it at this point.
Well, one would actually really have to take a cross-section and analyze it, but certainly concrete itself has a very limited R value, unless it's an air and train type concrete, but plain old structural concrete is going to transfer a lot of heat to the interior. So you are going to have a cold area there. Mm-hmm. And that cold area can be a great place for condensation to develop, especially if you end up putting carpeting on the floor. So I would really try to find a way of thermally decoupling that concrete slab if you can.
Yeah, you touched on it. Concrete's a sponge, basically, for moisture, mm-hmm. and it'll, through capillary action, it'll suck moisture in from the ground. And you could not just have condensation, but you could have moisture from the outside coming in. And your best bet is if you can insulate for the from the outside. That would really be the best thing. Barring that, I'm not sure what you can do. You know, John, I think you're right about cutting a little hole, seeing what's in there, seeing if you could put a thermal barrier in there.
And it's probably going to be very difficult. Yeah. The thermal resistance of concrete is 0.08, which is
It's nothing.
Terrible.
Nothing.
Yeah. It's just terrible.
Do you have insulation under the concrete, Keith?
No.
Yeah, that's not surprising.
Yeah, then exterior is really the way to go because we have, as Ken is suggesting here, the heat that is going down through the concrete into the floor as well as to the exterior. Now, that floor is going to be warmer, 55 degrees, soil underneath the floor, but still, there's more heat loss there, and the condensation issue is going to exist over that entire floor area.
All right. Good luck with that, Keith. And Judy in Centuria has a question about something that goes on a wall, not in a wall. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Judith, John, and Ken.
Hi. Hello.
Hello.
We are redoing about a 40-year-old house for a granddaughter, and it has one wall with wallpaper on that just seems impossible to get the wallpaper off.
First of all, you're a wonderful grandparent for helping out your granddaughter. That's very kind of you. And she hopefully she'll recognize it and probably help her granddaughter as a result. But taking wallpaper off that was not put on properly, and when I say put on properly, I mean there's a subsurface that you put on that's called sizing. It's kind of like a paint, and it makes the wallpaper come off easily. If you don't have that on, it's a nightmare. I call it a character builder, because you get into it, and you go, oh, we'll take care of this, and then, you know, X number of days later, you're going, what in the world did I get myself into? We find that if you are able to scribe the surface, there's a tool, a couple different types, but one has little teeth, and it's a roller with teeth, and you roll it on, and you basically put perforations through the wallpaper, and then you steam it. There's a special tool that you buy. You can't just use a regular, like a steam iron. That won't work. But you steam it. Then sometimes you can scrape it off. So you do it in like little 1 and 2 foot sections. So I don't envy you.
Hopefully, but how big an area is the wallpaper on, Judy?
It isn't a real large area. I would say just 12 feet.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's good.
Wide.
There's
yeah,
another
pot. It's not really big.
Go ahead.
No, it's not real big.
Okay. Well, then it's not too it's
not too big of a character builder.
So, get some good music, get a beverage of your choice, and go to get the rental equipment and go to it.
If it absolutely will not come off, and some of those old vinyls are that way.
Oh, yeah.
It seems like they're epoxy in place. You can use, like the Glidden Paint Company has a system. They used to call it the Glidwall. I think they've changed the name. Mm-hmm. But basically, you put a heavy acrylic latex paint over the wallpaper, and then you put a fiberglass mat over there, cut the edges, put another layer of paint, texture it, and basically it gives you what looks like a brand new plaster wall.
Yeah, they're pretty good looking, too.
We use this a lot, Judith, in old houses where you've got a lot of cracks in the exterior wall, and it glues over all of those cracks. The cracks may still move behind it, but several different manufacturers make these. It's basically an acrylic latex paint and a fiberglass mat, and I think if you call your local paint store, that may be the path of least resistance.
It's kind of like fiberglass wallpaper in a way.
It is. Oh. It's very much like fiberglass wallpaper.
That's an interesting way to think about it.
And great. It's great for repairing all kinds of disasters.
Well, good luck with that, Judy. It sounds like, as Ken said, a fun project to be taking on. We had an email from Kent. He says, my CMU block foundation wall in the basement of my 1962 ranch home has a horizontal crack between the 7th and 8th course in the 10-course wall. The deflection of the wall is less than a quarter inch from top of the wall to the floor. How serious is this? And if it is serious, how should I proceed to have this repaired or stabilized?
Well, there's actually a standard for that, fortunately. And Kent, I have good news for you. The standard that the National Association of Home Inspector uses is basically if it's out by a half inch, you need to repair it. If it's out by an inch, you need to replace it. And you're only at a quarter inch, so that's good. This crack developed in that area because that is frost pressure. So what happened is you had a fall where the gutters overflowed, the soil got wet when it froze, that ice, of course, developed lateral pressure, and it pushed that wall in. I think what you could probably do at this point is repair it, have it tuck pointed, maybe painted. Take some photos of it, some dated digital photos, and put it in your file. So if you sell the house 7 years from now, you can say, look, I fixed this back in 2014, and Freiberger said to take pictures so I could prove it. And make sure that your grading around the house is good. Make sure your gutters don't overflow, and hopefully you'll see no further movement in that wall.
Great. Thanks for that email. We also had an email from John in Green Bay, and I love this question. Can the interior 2x4 walls in a house safely support a hammock holding a large man if 1/4-inch screw eyes are used into the walls?
Will he be holding a beer? And if so, is it 12 or 16 ounces?
I think we should assume the largest beer, just to be safe.
Well, that's a good question. And usually the stud wall could handle it. The danger is in the fastener. A lot of people will use a lag bolt with an eye on the end of it. And sometimes if they're undersized, they can actually pull through. Hmm. So what I would do is I would get the biggest fastener you can find. Make sure it goes into the middle of the stud as deeply as possible. If you got 3.5 inches, you can use a 4-inch long screw and still have it stick out of the wall enough to get your hammock on it. And see how that works. So the biggest one, maybe 1/2-inch diameter. A better way to do it would be to drill straight through and put a carriage bolt through with a bolt on and washer on the other end. But, how are you going to talk your wife into letting you do that if you've already got her to let you have a hammock?
I got to say, I've got a hammock, and being in Wisconsin, you don't get that much time outdoors to use mm-hmm. it. So I'm thinking this indoor hammock thing is not a bad idea.
All you need is an electric blanket to go underneath, and you're all set.
Well, thanks for that email, John. Let's go to Chris in Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you today?
Good.
Good. I have an answer, and then I have a question.
Okay.
And I can guarantee the lady who wanted to know where all the blue jeans are coming from that there are not little squads of contractors running around stealing blue jeans off of human beings. I used to buy and sell vintage clothing, and there are what are called rag warehouses where all of your used clothing that you donate to wherever it is goes, and there's just miles and miles of used clothing in this culture, and that's what they cut up
okay.
for the insulation.
Great,
just
thanks.
So you know.
Thanks. And what's your question, Chris?
The question is, I went to the NARI Home Improvement Show a couple of years ago, and there was this new system for building houses, and these people were making incredible claims, which is that it can withstand an F5 tornado and that it doesn't cost that much more than a frame building. And it's basically a styrofoam shell that they pour concrete into. Oh. And I suppose the downside of this is that you better be sure where you want to have your windows and doors, because you're not going to be able to move them eventually. But I was just wondering if you could make a comment about whether or not there's some background on whether or not this system is working for people.
Great. Thanks for that call, Chris. John?
Yes. Basically, these are probably styrofoam forms, and there's reinforced steel that you can design to carry some pretty big wind loads, and F5 is a tremendous wind load. It's over 100 pounds per square foot, which is huge, but I'm sure that could be engineered. We do hydroelectric dams, after all. What you'd have to do is you'd have to really design the house structurally. One of the big problems we have with tornadoes is that we tear the roofs off houses because we don't have good ways of holding them down, and the suction is so tremendous, and also we blow out the doors and windows. So I've seen these systems. I've seen them work. I've also seen them probably screwed up 80% of the time. There's a problem keeping the walls straight. People start pouring the concrete, and they don't have things braced well enough, and the walls start getting crooked. So it's a good system, but you need to have a contractor who's done it before and really knows how to do it. I saw one in western Wisconsin that the homeowner tried to do, and it was basically what we call bulldozer bait by the time he was done. The walls in places had moved by 2 feet. So it's an interesting system because you can stucco the exterior. You can do a lot of different things with it. But I would have an architect or an engineer work on the design if you're in a high wind area. And do some double checking on the thermal characteristics, because 10 or 15 years ago, these were probably thermally pretty good. Compared to how we're doing things today, they may not be quite as good.
Well, you're looking at 4 inches of foam, basically 2 inside and 2 outside. That's about what these forms are, I think. Mm-hmm. And on the inside, or on both sides, they have channels every 16 inches of plastic, so you've got a thin, you know, maybe a half inch less insulation there, too. So,
yeah, and the type of foam they use is usually sort of a light, like a beadboard type, and that's only R4 per inch.
Yeah,
so that's not a tremendous amount. And then the concrete itself, as we said, is terrible unless you use air and train concrete. So I'm not sure that it is that great a system. Now, maybe they're making with thicker foam walls now than they did before. Mm-hmm. The nice thing about them, especially if you're stuck in the exterior, is you can really make them wind tight. Mm-hmm. And our heat loss due to air intrusion in most houses is as bad or worse than it is from radiant loss.
Well, we use them on basements from time to time.
Yes. So,
and they're great. Like you said, if you have to block the wall properly, there's nothing. There's few things as gut wrenching as watching the sidewall start to blow out because you didn't didn't prop it enough.
With all this wet concrete, that soon will be hard.
Heavy
wow.
concrete. Yeah.
Wow.
So good luck to you.
Yeah, thanks for that, Chris. And let's go next to David in Lake Villa, Illinois. Hi, David.
Hi. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having the show, and thanks, John and Ken, for sharing your wealth of knowledge.
Well, thanks much.
That's kind of you to say. Thanks.
The question I have is, I have a house that's built in 88, and it's fairly close to a major road. And I wanted to hear your thoughts and ideas on what are some potential solutions to sound insulation and maybe better soundproofing the walls.
Mm. That's a toughie. The problem that we have is what you really need to attenuate sound is mass. So a home that has like a stone veneer on it is really pretty good at attenuating sound because that stone does a good job of absorption. Vinyl siding is probably about the worst as far as sound going through it. So you could try to veneer the front of the house in stone, but you want to use real stone. You don't want to use like the plaster cast stuff that you get from Owens Corning. I mean, that's a nice product, but it's not going to be great for sound attenuating. The other thing is you have to take a look at your windows. And we had a B&B here in Madison that was built in the 1850s and was right off of Monroe Street. So it was noisy, and people couldn't sleep in the bedrooms. And what we had is Marvin Windows came in and made windows for us with quarter-inch plate glass. So again, mass attenuates. So this thick glass really changed the characteristics in these rooms. So maybe analyze your windows, take a look at your exterior cladding. The other thing is look at your landscaping. A stone wall in the front yard that is fairly high is going to do a good job of catching a lot of that noise. Planting trees doesn't do a thing. So think about mass. Do a little bit of reading online, acoustical science, and do take a look at the windows. I think that there is a company that makes quarter-inch plate glass storm windows also. Though I've been told that generally it's easier to get the quarter-inch plate glass in the actual operable windows than storms as well. And, of course, if you've got just thermal panes on your house, add additional storm on the outside so you make it into a triple-layer glass. Mm. Again, by that way, you're adding mass. I actually did that on my own house because I'm near Highway M. It was a little bit noisy, and I had thermal panes on the new area, but I went ahead and put glass storms on anyway, and it did make a difference.
It's interesting, John, because earlier in the program you were talking about how, you know, what is a wall? It's something that keeps things out, and we talked about things like, you know, cold and moisture and things like that, but also sound.
That's right. And David has a flow-through wall as far as sound is raised.
Sorry about that, David, but thanks for that call. You are listening to The Larry Miller Show. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry today, talking with Ken Adams and John Freiberger about home improvement and repair. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Coming up tomorrow at 11, it's time for Garden Talk. Barb Larson is the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Kenosha County. She'll share great advice for gardeners. And since it'll be Valentine's Day, we'll also talk about growing roses just for a little bit of fun. But right now, just for a little bit of fun, we're talking with Ken Adams and John Freiberger about home improvement and repair. And let's go back to the phones and Kim in Whitehall. Hi, Kim.
Hello.
Hi.
We just recently built an ultra-efficient home. We have 10-inch thick walls. We did dense-pack insulation, which also is a wonderful sound barrier. But rather than the physical plastic barrier, which they required, we did a liquid paint vapor barrier. What is your opinion of how well that works versus the plastic that Wisconsin requires?
It definitely works. In fact, generally, we were talking earlier about insulating historic homes, and the liquid paint barrier is usually our fallback, because how would you retrofit plastic? So I think that that is a fine way of doing it. But remember, Kim, that most of the moisture is going to enter the wall through air leaks. So make sure that your boxes are sealed where you have outlets or switches in the wall, that any wall penetration is very well sealed. And I think that the liquid vapor barrier was a better solution than the plastic sheeting would have been.
Yeah. Kim, do you have any insulation on the outside of the framing?
No. Well, we have, yes, there's 1 inch of a silver-lined foam type material, and then we have Tyvek over that, a Tyvek type material.
Well, so with a 10-inch wall, dense-packed, and you've got the polyisocyanurate, one-inch sheathing on the outside of that, I don't think the outside of your wall is ever going to reach the dew point, not in this environment. So that vapor barrier is not quite as big a deal as it would be on most of our houses.
Well, that's correct. And, of course, in the other 48 states, even the liquid-applied vapor barrier wouldn't have been required by code.
Yeah.
So I think you're in great shape there. You've done the best possible thing in Wisconsin.
What are your heating bills like, I wonder?
Well, we have a geothermal system. We're all electric. We don't have anything gas in the house. We figured gas prices were a little too volatile, so we have a geothermal system with a 4-ton water furnace. And our electric bills for the whole house, including electric dryer range, the heat pump, everything, have been running about $120 to $150.
I'm jealous.
We're all jealous. Well, thanks for
the hurricane-resistant home that's made by the Deltek company down in the Carolinas. That was the thing that really drew me to it, was the hurricane resistance, because of the extreme wind resistance. And I had a house torn apart around me by a tornado years ago, and I'm a little squeamish in bad weather, so the additional structural strength was appealing.
Well, thanks for that call, Kim, and yes, we're all jealous. So we had an email from Robin in Burlington. She said, we have a 49-year-old ranch house with walkout basement with very little insulation in the walls and the attic. What are some good inexpensive options for us for adding more insulation?
Well, the attic insulation that is probably the most cost-effective, and Ken, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think it's the plain old cellulose. You've got an inexpensive green material, ground-up newspapers with a fire retardant. But you want to make sure that you really analyze what you're doing. You want to make sure that that attic is adequately vented before you insulate. Now, it may still be on Larry's website, but coreevent.com is a website that we frequently suggest that our listeners go to, because it actually gives you worksheets on venting and a lot of really good information.
We'll have Carl put that up. I believe it's coreevent.com.
That is correct. It's a really a wonderful and useful website. And then make sure that you're dealing with a good contractor. The other thing that I think that you may want to spend money on, especially when it's nice and cold like this, is go ahead and have your house energy tested. Do some thermal imaging so you can see how much heat is coming through the walls, how much is coming through the attic. Do a blower door test, because as we said several times on this program already, air movement tends to move as much heat out of a house as radiant loss. So get, for about $300 to $400, get a little bit of science first and then start working on it. And what you may find is that by the time you do things like tighten up the air sealing and do the attic insulation, that your poorly insulated walls may not be much of a bother to you anymore, because you've already got your heating bills down so far and your house so comfortable that a further investment really isn't worth putting in.
All right. Thanks for that. And there was a comment on Facebook from Alan. The denim insulation is now available at both Home Depot and at Menards here in Madison. And I'm guessing that means probably at their other outlets as well. So going back to those blue jeans as interior insulation, let's go back to the phones and Tom in Milwaukee. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Tom here.
Yes, go ahead.
Great show. I wonder what the guest has to say about straw bale home construction in regard to migration of moisture.
Well, I've only been involved with one, and that one had a bunch of exterior problems, so we didn't look too much at the interior problems. I think that air movement is going to be very, very important. Obviously, once you have your plaster on the interior, you can always put a vapor barrier paint off of that, but you have to make sure that everything is sealed so you have no air movement through that straw. The other thing I like to see with straw bale houses is some of them are basically adobe. I mean, that's you know, that's what the purists do, even here in Wisconsin. But I would really like to see a Portland cement stucco on the exterior so we have a really good air barrier, so we have very limited movement. That way, what we are left with is the movement of still some heat through the wall, and that heat will have a tendency then to drive the moisture, at least in the winter, towards the exterior. We do have a Madison expert on straw bale houses who you could perhaps email, and that is Lou Host Jablonski, who I think has been on this program several times, and I believe his email is Lou at...
And that's L-O-U.
L-O-U at designcoalition.com. And my guess is Lou would be very happy to answer some questions for you. He's a very public-spirited sort of architect.
Great. Thanks for that call, Tom. Let's go next to Ray in Rhinelander. Hi, Ray.
Hi.
Hi.
You've covered your guests are fantastic. They've answered at least, I'd say, half a dozen of my questions already.
Well, that's good. We're very efficient that way.
Thank you.
But, I mean, this is something that really needed to be addressed on the radio because so many people, like myself, have made mistakes on vapor barriers, rehabbing houses, and things with the status quo. I'm really happy that you went through the history of the walls of houses and what they used to insulate with and et cetera all the way up to the present point where now we're actually having a reversal problem of having too airtight of walls. Mm-hmm. Well, so my question is it's kind of a broad question. So what would you not do in a situation or what situation would present itself where you should not tear out a wall and redo it, and whether it's exterior or interior, and what situation that you know that would come up that would really demand that? You've covered a lot of that, or have you left anything out? And I'll take the answer off the air. And
great.
Thank you very much
great.
For everything.
Thanks, Ray.
Right. Thanks for your kind comments, Ray. Well, two things. First, Ken had talked earlier about structure. And we do have some houses that develop structural problems over the years. Ken talked about the use of 2x4s, and we used to have this thing called balloon framing where sometimes the 2x4s are 20 feet long because you could get them that long.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And they went all the way from on top of the foundation to the roof, and then the second floor was nailed to the sidewalls, and the windows had no
headers.
So
they're almost like stilts, kind of.
It was.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
It was just a bunch of sticks. The windows had and doors had no headers over them because we relied upon the sheathing. And that worked just fine. But now just think of condensation in that wall for 100 years and those nails beginning to rust. Mm-hmm. So we really need to look at walls first for any structural movement. If we have structural movement, then we need to probably gut them on the interior, take a look at the framing, have an architect, engineer, or at least a home inspector come in, get that fixed to code. As far as just plain tearing things down, we frequently do see people, because the plaster is really bad, taking things down from the interior. I'm sure, Ken, you do this a lot. And then re-insulating. And you want to just be thoughtful when you do it. We've had houses where we've not touched the exterior. We've taken down the interior. And we've put an inch of foam on the interior underneath the new plasterboard. Ken, your thoughts on that? You've done a lot of this more recently than
sure.
I have.
We just finished a project last year that we took the siding off, took the sheathing off in sections from the outside, removed old urethformaldehyde foam insulation that had turned to dust, vacuumed it out, and then re-insulated with a combination of low-density foam in some areas, and in other areas, dense-pack insulation. So now their house is about the same size as mine, with the heat bill's about half.
That's great. Mm.
And it's very comfortable, so yeah. They're very happy with it. So you know, if in that situation they had an insulation that was ineffective, that had shrunk and was never. I mean, it was an idea that just didn't work.
That's right.
It outgassed poisonous gases for 15 years and then ceased to be any good. So, I mean, that's the worst of all.
So when it got not dangerous, it was time to replace it. Anyway.
That's right. Yeah. So it's really not. John had mentioned earlier, starting with an energy audit is a good idea, because if you've got a good energy auditor, especially in an area especially at this time of year when it's warm in the house and very cold outside, you could actually see the structure of your house. You could see if there's no header above a window. You could see these things because it measures the temperature, and the studs are a different temperature than the hollow cavities or whatever.
So you can really see the contrast.
You can, and so it's a good way to start.
We are going to continue talking with Ken Adams and John Freiberger about home improvement and repair after a look at the news from NPR. We are going to talk more about walls and insulation, but also talking about windows and ice dams, which are a big issue this time of year. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, and you can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org or post a question or comment on our Facebook page. Stay tuned. Like many things in life, it can be a little too easy to not pay attention to our home's upkeep until something goes wrong. But inevitably, something needs to be fixed, and we need advice we can rely on. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. Glad you could join us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're lucky to have two pros that know a lot and have a good time sharing their experience, too. Ken Adams of Adams Design Construction in Madison is here. Great to have you back with us, Ken.
Oh, good to be here.
And John Freiberger of Freiberger & Associates in Fitchburg is his partner for these programs. Always a pleasure, John.
Glad to be here.
Well, we are talking about all kinds of home improvement and repair, but we have some folks that have been waiting to ask their questions. So let's go to the phones right off the bat. Charlie in Appleton is up first. Hi, Charlie.
Yeah, good morning. I've got a cottage on pilings, and I have 18 inches of clearance at the worst part and maybe 2 feet at the best. And I wanted to enclose that, but the contractors told me not to because I'd create a moisture problem. Is there some way I can do that or insulate that floor? We're using it now, not just during the summertime.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So it's on piers. The floor is exposed underneath but not insulated. Is that correct?
Correct. That's correct.
It probably makes sense not to try to seal off the area underneath not to create another wall below that your house and then try to insulate that. It would make more sense probably to insulate the floor, and generally the best way to do that is to make sure that you can insulate in the floor cavity with you could. It's the 18 inches off the floor. You could probably use dense pack, or you could use a two-part polyurethane foam. And then over the top of that, or I should say underneath it, put however much insulation you can afford. 2 inches would be perfect, I think, of hard styrofoam insulation, like a polyisocyanurite or even the pink or blue foam. If you do one of the foams on top of that, you'll need to do a finish over the top of that so to protect it from insects and rodents. And that could be either plywood or you could apply a stucco finish. Anything to add, John?
Well, the last couple ones that we've done, we actually ended up putting in a perimeter wall.
And you did.
Well, remember on this one that Charlie's only got 18 inches of clearance. Mm-hmm. So how do you spray foam with 18 inches? That gets to be awful tight to try to work from below. The other thing is, I wonder if Charlie's got either heat or plumbing in this place.
Charlie?
I do have electric baseboard, but I use mostly wood heat.
Uh-huh. And do you have plumbing?
In the floor?
I do have some plumbing, yes.
Okay, so then we've got to try to keep that plumbing warm as well. Mm-hmm. Charlie, putting in a concrete wall or block wall or all that gets to be really expensive. But if you look at the Wisconsin Uniform Dwelling Code, which you can actually look at online, and if you look at Chapter 21, you'll see a thing called wood foundation walls.
Oh, that's an idea.
And you could actually dig around the exterior down to the frost, pour a small footing, and put a wood, treated wood exterior foundation wall. Now, the interior, your contractor's right, you got to worry about moisture. So what you're going to have to do on the interior is you're going to have to put down like a 6 or 8 mil visqueen and have it well sealed. But then you could come in and you could spray and or sheet foam or insulate this outside wall, so then you don't have to worry about the plumbing freezing. And if you ever put in heat, you could actually then run the heat through that crawl space and get rid of those very expensive electric baseboard heaters, because you're paying five times as much per BTU as you would for natural gas. Hmm.
So you're saying put a foundation wall in between his piers.
That's right.
So
and you could leave the piers in place, mm-hmm. and the foundation walls, you know, those piers are going to rot someday.
Yeah.
And we've run
this
into
will,
that.
This will take up some of the...
That's right. So then you've got more continuous support. And typically, these old cottages are really crooked.
Well, I'm wondering if it's an old cottage, if he's actually got piers that go down to the frost line, maybe this would be a chance to take care of that, too.
That's right. I think that maybe what we can do here is, by a little thoughtful work now, we can take care of some problems that might not develop for 10 years. But if your piers are beginning to rot off, well, the house is simply going to be supported by this wood foundation wall. So makes it more livable, makes it more heatable, gives you opportunities to change mechanical systems, and takes care of any structural deficits that might exist with the existing piers. And these tend to be crooked, so the use of spray foam is good, because the spray foam will take care of all these odd places where it's hard to get the wall plate to meet really nicely well with the floor plate. But we've done several of these, and they've worked out very successfully.
Sounds like a good solution. Thanks for that call, Charlie. Let's go over to Egg Harbor and Linda. Hi, Linda.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
About 15 years ago, we turned a two-car attached garage into living space, a great room. And the contractor, he said that he insulated, put up drywall. We have electricity in there. And now, 15 years later, we've noticed these black stripes coming through the ceiling at the same spacing as the studs would be in the roof line. And I'm wondering what that is and what happened and what we can do about it. Do we have to rip everything out and start from scratch?
All right. It looks like Ken has an idea of what's going on. Ken?
Well, if you're getting – this is coming through the roof, right, the ceiling?
It's coming through the ceiling, yes.
Okay. Yeah, there's a good chance that what you have up there is no ventilation. And it's a good possibility that you've got mold growing up in there. You've got, John, why don't you take it from here? This is...
Well, we've got two possibilities.
Yeah.
One is that we've got really bad news. The other is that we've got really good news. The really bad news would be the ventilation, and you do want to have that checked. And if you're not sure about it, call a home inspector. Tell them that all you need is, you don't need a full home inspection, but you need this attic ventilation and insulation check to make sure they know a lot about it. Get somebody who's a member of the American Society of Home Inspectors or the National Association of Home Inspectors, because they operate at a higher standard than somebody who's just a Wisconsin registered home inspector.
Have them look on the floor, too.
That's
another potential.
That's right. Have them basically look at the entire room, and they may find a problem. Now, let's look at the good news. Have you painted this in the last 15 years?
No, we haven't painted. And the other thing I should mention is that the ceiling is vaulted.
Right.
So they didn't put in a flat ceiling. They left it vaulted,
I already knew that. And how did I know that? Because what has happened there is, believe it or not, there's an electrostatic precipitation by the framing on vaulted ceilings, and the air currents are coming up there and taking dirt. What I think you'll find is that if you take a wet rag, you can wash it off. And I think what you probably need to do is paint the ceiling. And then you may be good for another 15 years. But as Ken said, let's go ahead and check. It's not going to cost a whole lot to have a home inspector come over and look at everything there. And then if he finds that there are no issues and you find this just wipes off, all this is dust and soot that has gathered there over the years. What we find in houses with flat ceilings is you'll find it along the outside walls where the walls and ceiling meet, because that's where the air current slows down and swirls. Cathedral ceilings have a lot more air currents. That air is rising with thermal buoyancy, and then is simply depositing the dirt up there.
All right. Good luck with that, Linda. And let's go next to Escanaba, Michigan, and John. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes, I have a couple questions. I have a home that I bought here in Escanaba. It was built probably in 1930s. It had, I can't think of the name of the siding. It looks like asphalt.
Okay.
It looks like roofing,
Yeah,
sure.
That's probably what it is. It's probably an asphalt roof.
Okay, and we had it blown insulated. I would say 15 to 16 years ago, and then about 5 years later, we had it sided. So they put styrofoam up before they sided it, so mm-hmm. it's well insulated. Now, in the beginning of the show, I missed the beginning. Did you say that? Are you saying that you shouldn't even bother using plastic as a vapor barrier?
No, we're not saying that. we have to be careful because every application, there's so many different possibilities that we have to defer to the Uniform Dwelling Code. And the Uniform Dwelling Code requires a vapor barrier on the inside of a wall in conventional construction unless it can be shown by someone with authority that that's not required. So it's probably the case that you need a vapor barrier on the inside of the wall. Now, we had talked about putting up plastic, 6 mil plastic inside as being one way of accomplishing this, and we also talked about vapor barrier paints. So you can actually buy a primer that's a vapor barrier. You paint that on the wall, and then you can finish coat it any way you want, and that will also give you some vapor protection, although you have to be careful with whatever you use because you want to make sure any openings are sealed properly. So that's what we were talking about. Okay?
Okay. Well, yeah, and could I comment on something?
Or? Sure.
Yeah, I have... Okay, so you're saying put the plastic on the inside. I was just curious about that, but I'm having problems like the lady that just called a while ago, only I'm just seeing black dots, and I know it's the drywall screws.
And so those are on your walls, not on the ceiling?
I just saw a couple on the ceiling. I see mostly on the walls, and I was told by a drywaller that I'm a painter by profession, so... I was told by a drywaller that it was from burning candles and stuff, and I just could not eat that answer at all.
Okay, so, John?
Well, it can indeed be dirt and soot. And yeah, houses, if I go in and inspect a house, I can tell whether somebody smokes or not. Because you can find every drywall screw on some ceilings on houses with smokers. And the ladies that have 400 cats and burn the scented candles all the time, their houses look the same as the smokers. So generally what this is, there's something, and I do not understand the physics of this, and I guess I better look it up before the next program, but there's something about electrostatic precipitation where we have solid framing and we have even more of that where we have metal screws and nails. Things tend to precipitate out, dirt tends to precipitate out around the dots. And your friend is thinking maybe you burn candles, so that puts a little bit of soot. But, sometimes our old furnaces aren't too good, and our ducts are a little bit dirty, and we had an oil furnace long ago, and we have some oil soot even though we have a new furnace. So houses can be dirty. If this is developing in the house and you've painted it in the last 3 or 4 years and you're finding it again, then I think maybe you need to have the ducts cleaned or you've got some other issues with the house. But generally, I found these not to be serious issues.
All right. Thanks for that call, John. And let's go to Jim in Soldiers Grove. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
We live in a 130-year-old story-and-a-half log house. And there's some blown-in insulation in the attic. I have to explore yet to see if it's in that 2x4 space. The rafters are made out of 2x4, so there's only about a 4-inch space between the plaster and the roof deck. And we've been considering how to insulate this roof. Our roofs on the outside, as you can imagine, are glaciers right now. And we're wondering what our options are for inside. And if you could comment, too, about the R factor of some of your ideas, I'd appreciate it.
Great.
Say, how old's your existing roof, Jim?
Actually, part of it was replaced this fall, and the rest of it needs to get replaced this summer.
Okay. Well, your logs themselves, if they're cedar or pine, are going to have an R of 1.33 per inch. So not a lot unless you've got really, really thick logs. it sounds like with the 2x4 rafters and the ceiling that we probably have very little insulation up there, so it's probably pretty cold, especially when we get near that outside edge. The problem, this is one of these things like you don't want to diagnose over the air because you really want to see it. And if you send me some, if you email me some photos, I can actually help you a little bit. I do a great deal of work on old houses, including log homes. But one has to be very careful. The reason that Ken asked about the age of the roof is if we had old roof that needed to be redone, what we'd probably look at with your log house is actually putting energy panels on the roof to make the roof the exterior envelope so that your attic wouldn't even have to be wouldn't have to be insulated. Mm-hmm. We do this on old log cabins. We also do it on builders' modern houses from the 50s and 60s where you have these nice cathedral ceilings or cottages up north that no one, like Charlie's, that no one expected to heat. And if the shingles are bad, we can put the energy panels on the roof, and it's like somebody's put a giant foam cooler over the top of your old log cabin.
It's a good
tremendous change in the thermal efficiency. So there are several ways of looking at it. Be happy to give you some free advice, and of course the advice will be worth what you're paying for it. But you can email me, and I believe that my email address is up on Larry's website. So send me a bunch of pictures and sketch a little plan if you can. And I would be happy to help you out.
Great. And we had an email from Jan in Wausau who says she has 6 to 7 inches of ice buildup. Is there a removal alternative instead of the steaming process?
6 or 7 inches of ice buildup.
I'm assuming on the roof.
On the roof?
On the roof, yeah.
Yeah, Carl, our honor producer, is saying indeed on the roof.
Okay, rather than waiting for spring. Well, you've got classic ice damming. And ice damming is an indication of another problem, and that's heat loss at the top of the walls typically. So not knowing your house, it's similar to the last problem. Last caller is that we don't know exactly what the details of your house looks like, so I can't give you a definitive answer. But typically, you've got too much heat from the house escaping through the top of the wall, and that is warming up the snow on the edge of the roof. It's rolling down a little bit, freezing, and then then some other water is just staying there, and it's building up and mm-hmm. building up and building up. And the biggest problem you can have from that is, well, there's a danger you could have an icicle fall on your head, which is just a horrible possibility. But you could also, for the house, you could also get water working its way up under the shingles and rotting out the edge of your walls. I had one client that their entire kitchen was destroyed by ice dams.
Wow.
The water just poured down in all over their cabinets. So you need somebody to look at insulation on top of the wall. You need to. They also need to look at the ventilation. You know, John and I are always going, make sure when you're insulating, you're doing proper ventilation. You'll need to talk to some professional. Somebody that really knows insulation and ventilation, and in Wausau, I'm sure there's some good people. So if you want to email one of us and we can maybe help guide you, we'd be happy to.
And actually, Tristan in Wausau is on the line also with an ice damming question, so let's do that follow-up now. Hi, Tristan.
Yeah, how's it going?
Good.
Good. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, we had a Decra metal roof put up about 4 years ago
mm-hmm.
because
nice.
We had had some ice damming prior. And since then, we had not had an issue until this winter.
Yeah.
And it's actually, we have some roofs over our front and rear stoop that, there's kind of like a crack between those and the main house. And we're seeing some sort of dripping coming in to the house from there and wondering what maybe strategies you'd recommend to sort of deal with that.
Let's see if we can understand this correctly, Tristan. You've got a main roof, and then you have a porch coming off of it, and right where those two roofs meet, you've got water coming in?
That is correct, yeah.
Okay. Well, it may not be ice damage. Do you have ice building up there?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, it shouldn't happen. I mean, it probably wasn't properly flashed. That would be my first guess. That would be the first thing, because these roofs, if they're applied correctly, it'd be very, very rare for you to actually you might get an ice dam, but it'd be very rare for it to actually leak into your house.
Yeah, if it's a good quality standing seam metal and it's correctly done. But sometimes when the valleys come together, we end up with some weak spots. Mm-hmm. And even with a standing seam roof, if you get enough water, it can work its way up over the over the little standing seam and come in. So you need to take a look at, let's get rid of the ice dam. Let's take a look once again, venting and insulation. And once again, for almost everybody who's having these ice dam problems, let's get a hold of an energy analyst while it's cold and get some thermal imaging and see what kind of heat loss you have. So let's get rid of those ice dams, because the metal roof is a nice barrier, but of course on houses we have ice and water shield, which is a nice barrier. But the problem is this ice does a lot of damage, from falling on your head to ripping the gutters off your house. And almost any roof, if you get enough ice and water, even if it's got a good barrier, it's going to find its way in somehow.
And so good luck with that, Tristan. And certainly ice damming is an issue that many people have and should be keeping an eye on. We also had another cold weather question here. Joe in Portage emailed, I had the exterior pane of glass in a single hung window spontaneously crack when the temperature hit 29 below. The Vetter Window Company is out of business. How do I go about finding a replacement?
Well, that's not an unusual problem. Glass will, you'll have a huge temperature difference, or the exterior temperature will drop and it'll crack. So you probably won't be able to do anything exactly right now. If it broke out and you've got an opening, you have to deal with it. But quite often you could take the sash out, put something temporary to block it in, and take it to a local window company, and they can put a new piece of pane of glass in. It's not that difficult. Good luck.
And any other, just in the last couple of minutes we have, any other issues that are really prominent when we're getting this much snow and these kind of unrelenting cold temperatures?
Weight is an issue.
Yeah, weight's a big one.
Weight is a big issue because I inspected a home yesterday and it had a 3-foot overhang by the living room window and it was twisted by the weight. I also looked at a house 2 weeks ago that had 200 or 300 feet of very expensive copper gutter, and every piece had been damaged by the ice slides coming down. So we really need to be concerned about water intrusion is number one, because especially on the newer houses, the wuzwood houses, we can end up with mold.
We call them plud, by the way, not plud. Plastic, not wood.
Plud.
Even the damaged kitchen cabinets.
We have to
worry a little bit about weight and the stress that is causing. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's happening is so many of our houses right now are clad with metal. And the wood that is in back of that metal is usually just what we call a white wood. It's a non-decay resistant wood. So let's wet that half a dozen times, and all of a sudden our wood behind our cladding is going to start to rot on us. Mm-hmm. So we really need to, we keep repeating, we need to have an energy analyst look at it. Anything is curable.
Well, right now we've got the added issues of we're going to have some good melting going on in the next few weeks, down here at least. I'm not sure how the northern part of the state is, but that's, you're going to see water coming in. Places that maybe have ice build up, you're going to see water. So,
all right, so keep an eye open.
Keep an eye out, yes.
Well, as always, great fun and great information. Ken Adams of Adams Design Construction, thanks so much for coming by.
Yeah, thank you.
And John Freiberger of Freiberger and Associates in Fitchburg. John, always a pleasure.
Thanks, and we look forward to seeing you again.
Yes, and I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller tomorrow at 11, time for Garden Talk. Barb Larson from the UW Extension office in Kenosha County will be with us. Stay tuned here on the Ideas Network.